Our Internet of Things just broke the whole internet. If you run Linux, watch out for dirty cows. Pediatricians revise the screen time rules, and millennials fall for more scams than seniors. All that and a whole lot more coming up on Tech News Today.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Tech News Today is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Tech News Today, episode 1625, recorded Friday, October 21st, 2016.
This episode of Tech News Today is brought to you by Casper, an online retailer of premium mattresses for a fraction of the price. Because everyone deserves a great night's sleep. Get $50 off any mattress purchase by visiting casper.com/TNT. Just enter the promo code TNT.
And by Tracker, a coin-sized tracking device that pairs with your smartphone and keeps you from losing your most valued possessions. Visit thetracker.com right now and enter promo code TNT for 30% off your entire order.
And by Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Rocket Mortgage brings the mortgage process into the 21st century with a fast, easy, and completely online process. Check out Rocket Mortgage today at quickenloans.com/TNT. Hello, welcome to Tech News Today. We barely got here. The internet broke. I think Jason broke it.
I didn't do anything. I just tried to use it.
I tried to use it, too. You probably did, too. I hope you're here. I hope your internet is working so you're watching right now. I'm Megan Maroney.
And I'm Jason Howell. I'm the DD and you're the OS.
Exactly. Yeah.
Today. Mm-hmm. We're going to talk all about that. We're not going to get to that right off the top because we don't want to depress you with the very first story. So we'll talk with Nicole Lee about that a little bit later. But right now, let's talk a little bit about AT&T. Yesterday, Alex Wilhelm from Mattermark addressed the possibility that AT&T might be interested in acquiring Time Warner. Today, sources are now telling Wall Street Journal that a deal could be announced as early as this weekend. Discussions apparently moving super swiftly in this case. This would be one of the biggest media acquisitions in recent years, with Time Warner's market cap of $71 billion, along with AT&T's market cap of $231.7 billion. That's a lot of billion dollars. Late morning trading saw Time Warner shares rise 9.6% on the news, with AT&T's shares falling 2.6%. Obviously, in this case, there would be regulatory analysis that would have to kind of take place here. I think they're maybe a little gun shy as far as that's concerned, in light of, you know, some of the issues that came up around Comcast and NBC Universal back in 2011. But there's a lot of kind of similarities between those deals and this one. Yeah, pretty big deal.
I think owning one company owning content and distribution is always bad for the customer. It's never good news for the customer. So I hope that this doesn't go through. I mean, they broke up AT&T for a reason. And so, like, to have it build back up and now in a new era, you know, where so much of our content is consumed using technology, I think that, I don't think this will be good news. If it passes, I mean, it would probably be good news for Time Warner, but not for us, the consumer.
And for AT&T, considering the fact that Time Warner has, I mean, one of the crown jewels in media, you know, content and stuff, you know, everything along those lines, HBO. Then you've also got CNN, you've got DC Entertainment, Warner Brothers Pictures, TNT and TBS, which get a lot of sports, you know, sports content, sports programming. Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I don't know if it ends up getting seen through a more strict kind of regulatory process because of, you know, kind of what you're talking about. But it's not like we haven't seen it before, you know, back in 2011, obviously. Also back in the early 2000s with AOL and Time Warner. And we see how that turned out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the Wall Street Journal also said Apple and Google, their analysts said Apple and Google were also looking to buy Time Warner.
At this point, I just kind of think Apple and Google are always looking at whatever is being thrown around. You know what I mean? Because you always end up hearing, at least I know with Google, maybe less so with Apple, but they come up as well too. But it's like when you've got that amount of money and you know that some deal is, you know, some the potential deal is on the table, you investigate it because you don't necessarily, you have no reason not to, and you don't necessarily know why or why not, you know, until you look into it. So but it always seems to come up like that, mm-hmm. right? Like big deals happening and Google's interested too, but then Google ends up not being interested. So.
Right. Yeah. I mean, they said Apple's monitoring the situation, but then so are we.
Yeah.
That did not make the news.
It's true.
Well, it is time to patch your Linux boxes. And if you have any Linux lovers in your life, it's time to tell them to do the same. Ars Technica reports that a flaw in the OS could allow an unprivileged local user to gain write access to otherwise read-only memory mappings, thereby increasing their privileges on the system. Now, in true vulnerability fashion, this vuln has a memorable name. Researchers found the so-called dirty cow rooting flaw in the way Linux memory handles, not because it moves, it's the way that Linux memory handles a duplication technique called copy on write. So C-O-W, cow. Patch your Linux boxes, people. You probably already know that if you're running Linux. I thought this was worth mentioning.
9 years ago. Just kind of been hanging out there, sitting on the beach, wearing a pair of sunglasses, soaking up a tan, just waiting for something to happen.
That dirty cow.
And I mean, this exploit code, it's being seen in the wild. So this is not just one of, at least as far as we could read here, it's not one of those cases where, this could theoretically, exploited. It's out there already. Red Hat, Debian, Ubuntu, they've all released fixes. I looked up to see if Google had made any sort of comment on this whatsoever because, as we know, Android is based on Linux, the Linux kernel. So I would imagine this affects Android as well. And if that is the case, apparently it's just a couple of lines of code to make the change that to protect the OS. So Google's been really good on the kind of the security update side of things, doing this monthly security update every month. So I would imagine if that is the case, it would be an easy fix, probably be rolled into one of the next security updates, but we haven't heard from Google officially on that. And then, of course, the big rub there is who ends up getting that, because not everybody that has an Android device gets that. So Google's acquisition of the DoubleClick ad network back in 2007 came with assurances from founder Sergey Brin that privacy of its users would be respected in light of the deal, meaning the identity of its users would not be tied to DoubleClick's database of browsing records. Sometime this summer, lines within Google's privacy policy that proclaimed its commitment to not sharing that information between services were crossed out. In its place, Google substituted new verbiage that opens that door, basically saying that browser activity may be combined with the information Google has on its users. Google attributes the change to the smartphone revolution, they say, put it in that phrase, added that users' experience won't change if they don't explicitly opt into it. And I remember actually seeing, it was a couple of months ago, I remember on a few different devices, it happened a couple of times, even though I was using the same account, it was a new kind of like page, like, help us make your experience better. And it listed, a bunch of things or whatever, and down at the bottom, yes, I'm in, or no. And then, are you sure? Kind of trying to move you into this area. So yeah, it's opt-in. It would be easy to kind of overlook, and I imagine a lot of people probably did. So
yeah, if you're watching the video, you see where like I went through, and it's like that's how you opt in. No changes, continue on your way. No changes, review key privacy settings more fully, or yes, I'm in, turn on the new features. So one wishes that third was yes, I'm in, turn on the new features, which means that you will now, your name and other personal information and possibly words from your Google account will be associated with your ad preferences. Yeah. But it doesn't say that. This is from Julia Angwin in ProPublica. ProPublica does great work. She herself has done great work in privacy and has sort of uncovered this thing that we all just, even like Wired and the New York Times, just sort of said, okay, yeah, there's some new settings. Like no one really looked as deep as she did. Basically she says Google could now, if it wished to, build a complete portrait of a user by name based on everything they write in email, every website they visit, and the searches they conduct. It's Facebook already does this, basically. They already do mix our information. Google hasn't. They promised that they wouldn't, and now they've taken back that promise. So that was the one thing that we always could depend on. Well, yes, like we'll be targeted in ads, but not.
That's the screen that I saw.
Yes, that's the screen you see, and then you go through, and that last screen you click through, and that's what you get to actually opt in. And you don't really understand what you're opting into.
Yeah, there's a lot of words. They're obviously trying to educate you on what you're doing, but I know when I saw this, like I didn't do my due diligence. I read through part of it, but I didn't really, and apparently I'm not alone, you know, totally scrutinize exactly what that was. So if you need to, you can go into your activity controls in Google's My Account page and uncheck. There's a box right there up at the top that says include Chrome browsing history and activity from websites and apps that use Google services. And you can uncheck that and it'll ask you if you're sure. And remove that. And that's basically you re-opting out if you opted in and you didn't realize that you did. Because, I mean, basically, Google has held strong for years and years, avoiding kind of this collision of these two efforts. You know, when they bought DoubleClick, they basically said that wasn't going to happen. And then now it like silently, or maybe not so silently, but, not so obviously either, just kind of went away to provide a quote better experience. And you pay a certain price in privacy when you do that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And the ads will be less relevant to you.
Yeah.
If you
want
to keep
all this in the name of the ads you see, like, who cares? I don't know. At some point I'm like, why do I even care that I see more pertinent ads? I most of the time my eyes don't even see the ads anymore. So
right. Well, I mean, the idea is that you would rather have your privacy. You'd rather have that information separated than see more relevant ads, right?
Right.
But they're not saying that. They are.
It behooves them not to. Yeah.
It appears that everything they've done is actually legal, and it's not even like cloaked under those three pages of legalese where everyone accepts. It's beautiful drawings, the Google-esque stick figures, and say yes, come to me, give away your information.
Yeah.
Well, those of you who feel guilty about letting your under 2-year-old children have some screen time can now feel redeemed because you were all giving them screen time anyway. Today, the American Academy of Pediatrics lifted the recommended ban on screens for the under 2 set. Now, the guidelines were first introduced in 1999, and they have been overhauled to focus not just on the screen time itself, but what is on the screen and who else is in the room. Now, if your child is under 18 months, they still don't recommend any screens except video chatting with relatives and, of course, watching Tech News Today.
Yes, good. I'm happy they added that last part of it.
So, yeah, I mean, it's what they're saying basically is screens have value, for kids under 2. They can learn. There's been some research, not a ton of research, but they say some value with like chatting with grandparents kind of thing, mm-hmm. playing peekaboo, like there's some developmental value. So ages 2 through 5, they say no more than 1 hour a day. That's the AAP. They recommend a family media plan to determine what's best for your family, because everybody's family is different, and the parents should co-view media with children to help them understand what they're seeing and apply it to the world around them. And that sounds great and is totally impractical.
They always say that, and you always try as a parent. I know I've tried so many times, but you can't always. It's just, you're right. It's just not always that practical. But it's, I'm happy that they made the change only because parents were doing a certain thing all along anyways, and all you had was like this guilt associated with it because, you were, and why were you? Because that's just the way the world is now. There are screens everywhere, and it's just like an undeniable fact that we all have screens, and it's part of how we live our life. And I don't know what B was, but that's my main point.
A and B
is CA. I don't know. I think this is a little bit more realistic. The 1 hour time limit between ages 2 to 5, like you said, isn't applicable to things like video chat. Also like taking photos, which I love it when my kids grab a phone and start taking pictures because I feel like that's an expression of creativity. Shooting video, maps, information gathering. Although if they're 2 years old, how much information are they gathering? But I mean, you'd be surprised. I see my 6-year-old knows how to search Google with her voice, even if she can't type out her thing. So they learn fast.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I think the basic thing is these rules came when there was Sesame Street or, Law and Order. Those were the things you could watch on TV. And so now it's just there's so much educational software. There's so much on YouTube and there's so much to be learned on YouTube. There are also ads on YouTube. So, and my big thing with screen time is what are you doing what are you losing? Like, are you, you know, are you watching informational videos on YouTube instead of running around outside?
Right.
Or instead of reading a book? You know, that's the thing. It's not like there's necessarily the stuff on the screen is bad. It's just like, what were you doing before?
Yeah, and I find this very, very interesting. They have a media time calculator on the site, so you can enter in the age, you know, of your children and name and everything to make it, keep it organized or whatever. And then it plots out a 24-hour day. And when it starts out, it's like it's got this big block of sleep and, you know, all of these little categories that you have yet to enter in how much time your child spends doing those things. And then it has this big block at the bottom of screen time, like right here. It says 10 hours. And when I first saw this, I was like, whoa, wait a minute. I would never give my kid, this is a 24-hour scale. I would never do 10 hours. Not realizing that what you do with this is you actually go through and you say, well, how much time are they going to spend, you know, playing actively? How much time do I want them to spend eating their meals, doing their homework, blah, blah, blah. And as you do that, the screen time kind of peels down and down and down. So you get your priorities out of the way. And instead of making this blanket statement of your kids should only have, you know, 30 minutes per day, it's really like, well, if they've done everything else that you really want them to be sure to do on a daily basis, then you're left with this. And I mean, why not? It's not going to hurt them. So I think that's a good approach. There have been a number of incidents in recent months where Facebook has removed posts on the site, not based on the context of the content, but based simply on the presence of Facebook's, you know, announcing that these things are breaching community standards. And then, of course, later they're considered newsworthy. And so they end up going back. That further challenges the company's repeated claim that it's not a media company, which is kind of a strange thing that they keep going back to. Facebook plans to work with their partners and community in order to determine the best way to do this effectively going forward. They're just basically kind of changing, allowing certain pieces of explicit content if they deem it newsworthy, which again kind of goes against their repeated claims of not being a media company, because here they are kind of deciding these factors.
Right.
And harder and harder to say that as Facebook.
And not only that, but who's going to do this? Like, how are they going to do this? Like, they really just said, like, here's what we're going to do, but how would you possibly decide what's newsworthy or not? I mean, they even just this week they had to apologize for removing a breast cancer video. It was a breast cancer awareness video that you know had boobs in it, so they removed it. Mm-hmm. And you know, I just think that they're not up to this task, and they need to be. You know, and it's a global company. When I worked for Microsoft, it was amazing. Every time we put an image up on one on a page on the website, you know, because it's global, you had to check, you know, really on, is it okay for a woman to be, you know, talking to a man in that picture? Is it, you know, there's so many different issues to deal with. And I don't know, like, what's appropriate for us versus what's appropriate for someone in another country is totally different. So I just don't know how they're going to do
this. Yeah, I mean, especially for a global company, that is an insane challenge. Twitter does this. They tackle it. Their regional issue is something called country withheld content. So, for example, if you're using Twitter inside Germany, that would block pro-Nazi content in Germany, let's say, where maybe in other places it wouldn't. So kind of on a regional basis, determining what topics. But still, I mean, that's an insane challenge to regulate and report on, and you're guaranteed to mess that up somewhere along the way, because there are no strict kind of lines through the sand as far as that's concerned.
True. Well, after the break, we barely survived this morning's internet outage, and Nicole Lee from Engadget is here to tell us how it might have happened. But first, let's take a minute to thank Casper, the sponsor of this episode. Casper is an online retailer of premium mattresses for a fraction of the cost. Casper is revolutionizing the mattress industry by cutting the cost of dealing with resellers and showrooms and passing that savings directly to the consumer. Casper's mattresses are obsessively engineered, and they come at a fair price. They combine two technologies, springy latex foam and supportive memory foam, to create an excellent mattress. I know, because I have slept on one and my children sleep on one as well. A Casper mattress provides long-lasting comfort and support, breathable design. It sleeps cool to help you regulate your temperature through the night. I can't say more about this process. I love that you can try it out. If you don't like it, you might like to sleep on something that I don't like to sleep on. If you don't like it, they will take it back. It's risk-free. try it. Casper understands the importance of truly trying out a mattress that in reality you spend a third of your life on. It. They offer free delivery and painless returns. You can try it for 100 days. That's a lot of days of sleeping. Then you can decide. Statistically, lying on a bed in a showroom has no correlation as to whether that bed is right for you. The Casper mattress is engineered to meet that Goldilocks standard of just right, so it's not too hard and not too soft. Those mattresses uphold the highest environmental standards and are made in the USA. Casper offers free shipping and returns to the US and Canada. So get a Casper mattress today. It's $500 for a twin, $950 for a king. Compared to industry average, that is a great price. And you can save an additional $50 towards a mattress purchase as one of our audience members by going to casper.com/TNT. Just enter the promo code TNT. Casper.com/TNT with promo code TNT. Terms and conditions apply.
All right. When internet users lose their internet, everyone loses their minds, which is pretty much what we saw today. Joining us and continue to joining us to talk about today's gargantuan denial of service attack on a large domain name server called Dyn is Nicole Lee from Engadget. How's it going, Nicole?
Hello. How's it been? The internet is back.
Is it back? Well, yeah, things seem to be moving back a little bit faster. We're able to do this show. We're able to connect to you.
Right.
I mean, but this has been an all-day sort
fingers
of
crossed
thing. Yeah, exactly. Keep those fingers crossed. There might be another one. So when did the first wave of DDoS attacks happen today?
Well, according to Dyn, it started around 7 o'clock Eastern. So around like 7:10 a.m. Eastern is when the first attack began to show itself.
And DNS host Dyn was the primary target of the attack. Yeah. What sites were involved in that? Because I know, like, I was trying to hit Twitter, and Twitter had a whole lot of issues. It was like major
several
sites.
Several different sites. I mean, Twitter was affected, as well as Box, which is used a lot for file sharing. Twitter, Netflix, I think, as well. So Twitter, Box, Netflix, the New York Times, Reddit was affected, Yelp, Pinterest, and PayPal. Wow. And this is just like a small sampling of what Dyn hosts.
Yeah, right. Yeah. So let's see here. There have been three kind of consecutive attacks that I've known of anyways. There was the attack in the morning, a little bit later, and then there was one very recently. Are we kind of coming out of the other side of this at this point that we know?
Yeah, so the first attack started around 7 o'clock. The second was around noon Eastern, sort of. And then the third started around 3 or 4 o'clock Eastern. And right now, it seems as if it's been resolved. According to Dyn, the third attack has been resolved. So hopefully we're sort of past that point and we're good. But who knows? According to Dyn, it's a very well-planned and executed attack from tens of millions of IP addresses at the same time. So it's a very like well-executed attack, not just like a guy doing it in his basement. You know, like this is a very well-planned, very well-executed thing.
Yeah, and they've even mentioned links to, is it Mirai? Mirai, it's a kind of source code that was publicly released very recently that seems to light up Internet of Things. And we've talked about on the show many times kind of the insecurity of the Internet of Things. Brian Krebs also has talked about this. Is it possible in all of this that we actually have devices in our homes that are kind of being, you know, botified for attacks like this?
Right. So exactly, some of these Internet of Things devices that are being listed as insecure are things like routers, security cameras, DVRs. So these are basically your everyday household things that are connected to the internet. And because it's such a new industry, like IoT is such a new and nascent industry, it's not as regulated as well as it should be. So they're very vulnerable to these attacks, and they're very vulnerable to malware, like the Mirai malware, for example. Mm-hmm.
So we talked about this a few weeks ago when Brian Krebs' site went down, and you know, we said, well, what can consumers do? And there's really nothing consumers could do. I mean, this was really something that the Internet of Things, you know, the creators of these devices, like, they don't make it easy. You don't know how to update. It's not just like, oh, okay, I got to update my Windows, or, you know, got to update my Mac. Like, what can people do to secure their Internet of Things devices besides just not using Internet of Things devices?
I suppose that would be the easiest way, so just to not use them. But, you know, a lot of them can be updated. I think routers can definitely be updated, for sure. I know that. depends on the device. I mean, it's really hard to say which device can be updated or not because they're so different. There's no one standard for IoT either, so it's really difficult to say, you know, which can be updated or not. But my suggestion would be to update if you can, and if you can't update it, maybe don't use it for a while, or find an alternative for it, perhaps. Routers, there are routers that are more secure than others. I'm not really sure of the list of it, but routers, for example, you can always find there's obviously a list for it, like more secure than the other ones, but it's definitely a hard thing to really pinpoint.
Especially when you have all of these different hardware manufacturers, you know, creating these devices for the home, if they don't have security in mind, and many of them, it's just not, I mean, they haven't had reason to, so they weren't necessarily built with that in mind. I mean, some of them probably have a much better kind of track record, better attention to updating that hardware in light of situations like this. Some of them probably it's not a priority because it's not their primary business or whatever. They just happen to have a device that connects to the internet that also controls something in your home. It's a huge challenge. Krebs mentioned extortion is a tool for criminals like the ones that are carrying out attacks like this. They haven't linked extortion in this case directly yet. But in that case, the fact that these attacks are capable of up to 1 terabyte per second, some of these criminals are saying that there are, at this time, no protection systems that are strong enough to protect against that kind of an attack. If that's true, are we just destined to see more and more of these? Like, are we entering a new era of kind of DDoS insecurity on the internet right now?
I think the IoT botnet, for example, is a relatively new way of doing this kind of large, massive scale DDoS attacks. So even if we solve this one, even if we manage to like sort of plug the hole of this particular attack, there's going to be more. There's going to be more of it because, you know, as Krebs mentioned, it's one of those things where it's just going to keep happening. And unfortunately, according to many news sites that I've read today, the DDoS attacks will still happen, even though we stop one right. method of attack. They will still think of other methods of attack. So it's a never-ending fight. And I think this is why we need to invest more in cybersecurity. We need to invest more in, you know, protecting our sort of our cyber ways in a way.
Mm-hmm. So we know what happened. We know how they did it. What about the why? I mean, I've read it's like, someone responding to Julian Assange from WikiLeaks, whose internet got cut off. So this was like in retribution for that. Do you have any ideas about like who this might have been and why they did it?
So WikiLeaks did tweet earlier today that they're saying, you know, something like they were saying they apologize for their supporters trying to like attack the U.S. or something like that. So there have been reports and reports from security researchers who basically they doubt that this is actually happening. That according to their data, according to the report that they have, they really doubt that the WikiLeaks. There's anything to do with WikiLeaks, essentially. So the reason is because these groups, the anonymous groups, have claimed responsibility for things they haven't done before. So it's very possible this is not their particular responsibility. It could be something else entirely. I think it's very easy to politicize this, and maybe it is a political thing. Maybe it is a Russian hack or something like that. But there's really no evidence right now to say one way or the other. And I really hesitate to point any fingers at this time until we have more proof.
Absolutely. And I'm sure we're going to find out about that throughout the course of the weekend. If we don't find out that we have no internet throughout the course of the weekend first, we're going to need a little bit of internet in order to find out that other piece of information. Nicole Lee with Engadget, thanks so much, as always, for coming on. We really appreciate it, Nicole.
Bye.
Have a great weekend. See you later.
David Cara Medini writes, someone recently complained to us that when listening to TNT on the ubiquitous smart assistant, who shall not be named, said assistant was triggered whenever you mentioned the trigger word. I have a solution. When listening to a podcast on the smart home device, just push the microphone mute button. The show will keep playing. She will ignore all of your mentions of said smart assistant. Problem solved. You're welcome.
Maybe we just need to change our references to said smart assistant to said smart assistant.
Maybe we should just say said smart assistant. Yeah, sorry. I mean, when I am listening to said smart assistant and said smart assistant mentions said smart assistant or someone else mentions the name of said smart assistant, it doesn't trigger necessarily, but I guess maybe if I'm saying it, I might, maybe my voice sounds a lot like your voice out there.
Right. Maybe your voice is like generic voice.
Mm-hmm. Maybe.
Insert generic voice here. But then I've said it too. I'm sure I've triggered it. So maybe we're just generic. Mm-hmm. We're too generic.
We are.
Mm-hmm. Got to work on that. You millennials might be really bad at spotting scams. That much, I think we know. We're going to talk a little bit about that. But first, let's take a minute to thank Tracker, the sponsor of this episode. With advancements in technology, we have smart cars, smart phones, smart homes. But then you lose your possessions and you feel not smart at all. Well, the Tracker makes losing things a thing of the past. Tracker Bravo locates misplaced keys, wallets, computers, backpacks, bicycles, even pets in seconds. The coin-sized device is constructed with anodized aluminum for the thinnest, most durable tracking. You can easily attach it to whatever your items happen to be. It has a key loop or adhesive. Tracker is enabled by Bluetooth LE, so the battery lasts up to 1 year. You can add a laser-engraved message to each Tracker Bravo, like return or pet information. You can personalize your tracker with a custom printed image to make it look all fancy and just your own. You can pair Tracker to your iOS or Android device, find its precise location with a tap of a button. And it's got a single button on it. It's about as easy as it gets. Your phone can track up to 10 devices at once. You can also customize two-way separation alerts so you're notified before you leave your item behind. If you happen to leave your phone or lose your phone somewhere, maybe in the car, you press the button on the tracker and your phone's going to ring even if you left it on silent. Tracker Atlas works with your Tracker Bravo or third-party Bluetooth tracker to pinpoint your items on a customizable floor plan of your home. Save time, save energy. All you have to do is ask Tracker Atlas where your item is and you're going to instantly get an answer and you won't need to search for it. With over 1.5 million devices, Tracker has the largest crowd GPS network in the world, so your last item shows up on a map even if it's miles away. If you lose your item, the Tracker app records its last known location on a map, and then when another Tracker user comes within 100 feet range of your item, you're going to receive a GPS update of where your item is located. Go to thetracker.com and never lose your possessions again. Plus, just for our audience, if you enter promo code TNT, you're going to get 30% off your entire order. That's thetracker.com. Promo code TNT for 30% off your entire Tracker order.
Well, the Next Web was one of the websites that was down for a big part of the day. But luckily, Brian Clark gave me his phone number so I could text him lots of lasers on iMessage, which he understood meant I wanted him to come on and talk about some of the crazy stuff he's written about. Welcome, Brian Clark, reporter at the Next Web.
Hi, guys.
So let's get to your first crazy story. A new poll says millennials fall for more tech scams than their grandparents. Tell us about this poll.
Okay, so there's a poll that says the most likely victims of a tech support scam are millennials, which are 18 to 34-year-olds. Sadly, I fall into that group, and it made me really wonder because people like my mom, I said at the end of the article, like the one thing that kept me from really believing this is I know that my mom tried to give a stranger her email password on a flight once so that he could fix an issue with her iPhone. And it's completely anecdotal, but it makes me not even close to able to believe this.
So what do you think about the polling method itself? You said you had some doubts about the way that they did this poll.
Yeah, I think the methodology is a little bit flawed because millennials, first of all, are the largest generation now. They overtook baby boomers some time ago. And until you get a poll that's commensurate with the actual population, meaning there's more millennials in the poll than there are 55-year-olds or whoever else you're polling, the data is not really going to be accurate. So, I mean, you can take two 55-year-olds, and if neither of them have ever fallen victim to a tech support scam, obviously, it's 0%. So you would assume that most of the people responding to this poll were millennials. So that data is probably pretty accurate, but I really question the data from the other sources.
But if you think about it, I mean, we're, you know, people over 55, like we've had, you know, we've had Nigerian email scams for a while now. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, it's not just, it's like
at least a couple of weeks.
I actually quit my job today because I just won $1 million.
Oh, you too?
Nigeria, yeah.
Well, I just think when we think of, you know, when I think of my grandparents, definitely not, you know, it was hard for them. But like, you know, grandparents are getting younger these days. So I do think and you know, the millennial starts at 18. So I do think maybe there is something to say about, you know, being young and naive and, you know, you first falling for these scams when you first get a phone or you first get email or something like that.
Yeah, I can't argue with that. I mean, the data could be completely legit because the reality is all of us are terrible at cybersecurity. Even me, I write about it regularly and I know what to do to protect myself, but that doesn't mean I'm not too lazy to create long passwords for some things or to enable two-factor authentication. So the reality is we're all pretty terrible at it. I just, you know, I kind of questioned there being that big of a gap between the ages.
What is your password, Brian?
I'll text it to you.
Okay.
Social engineering. I like it.
Yes.
just checking.
She's a master. And there's something I wanted to clear up real quick. There's a thing in business that you guys are aware of, I'm sure, that you release bad news late in the day on a Friday. And looking over the last, well, every time I've been on the show, it's always been on a Friday. Are you trying to tell me something here?
No, actually, I think,
Yeah. Okay.
And what is your password again?
Yeah. I just texted it to you. Let me know if you got it.
Great. All right. Let's move on to another story you did. Samsung is using takedown notices on some YouTube videos featuring the Note 7. What's the story here?
So this is ridiculous. There's never been a more clear-cut case of parody in my mind. But Samsung is sending DMCA notices to people who installed this Grand Theft Auto mod that made the Note 7, a mobile weapon of destruction where you can throw it or lay it down and blow up cars and things like that. Samsung didn't like it. I guess, you know, they've been having some issues, so I don't think they feel like laughing about it right now. But parody is protected under copyright law. And this is obviously a clear-cut case of parody because no one's attempting to profit off Samsung's intellectual property here. So the idea that they're going to go all around the internet and try to remove this is ridiculous.
Well, yeah, and I mean, it pretty much just reappeared like a day later anyway. So if that's right. if that's their plan, it's a pretty bad plan. It's kind of whack-a-mole at that point, and it's not going to really work so well for them.
It's kind of like, I don't know if you saw this, but there was a fan-made Metroid game recently that Nintendo kind of smacked around and got pulled. There was a fan-made Sonic game where Sega's like, this is great, keep doing it. So I think Samsung's very much taking the Nintendo angle here and might be alienating some of the people that were big fans of them before.
Well, Samsung wants nothing more than for everyone to stop talking about this. Mm-hmm. So I'm not surprised at all that they would try to do that.
Yeah. Every time we post about this, they're like, you know, other phones explode too, right? Like, yeah. Not recently. not with the same frequency.
We're emerging from the Note 7 smoke at this point. Mm-hmm. We're coming out the other end. So.
Right. So, okay. So then let's move on to a story where we say something bad about the iPhone. You said that Apple made two different kinds of iPhone 7s and one of them sucks. How do I know if I got the one that sucks?
The easiest way is to... Well, I mean, it really boils down to your mobile phone carrier. Verizon, Sprint, and SimFree are unlocked phones. They generally have the faster modem. One of these modems is made by Qualcomm, one's made by Intel, and there's a 30% difference in speed. So chances are if you have the slower modem, you're probably not going to notice it unless you grab someone else's iPhone and realize how much faster it really is. And Apple did this last year, too. In the 6S, they had two separate processors. And there was this big stink about, you know, one of them's faster than the other. But it was really only marginally faster. Like, there's really nothing to worry about there. But 30% isn't marginal. Like, that's a really significant difference in speed. And unfortunately, T-Mobile, AT&T, Telstra, and some others have the slower modem.
Marginal or not, if there is a difference, and there is a difference that results in any sort of net positive, there is a certain segment of users, both on iOS and beyond, that is going to be obsessive about making sure they get the right one. Case in point,
Josh Windage here at Twit, who probably went back and forth through like five different iOS devices last time, trying to find the right one to get the better of the two. So people get freaky about it.
As a T-Mobile user, I'm pretty upset. I actually have this lower one. But if the other way to check is to look at the back, if it's model A1778 or A178, let me look, 1784, that's the faster one. So you're fine. As long as it's one of those two, you're good.
Cool.
And I'm not. So you guys can all cry for me. And then I'll switch providers. John Legere, I hope you're listening.
So that's on your iPhone 7. You have the iPhone 7.
Yeah.
It's probably fast enough. I mean, what do you need to do with it that's not... It's not fast enough.
That's
not the spirit.
That's really not the point here, yeah.
That's not the point.
If you can buy two of anything and you know for the same price one of them is better, I mean, you're always going to feel slighted.
Mm-hmm.
That's true.
Exactly.
Well, Brian, thank you so much for joining us on a Friday. We'll try to get you on earlier in the week.
How about a Tuesday? Next time we'll make sure you're on a Tuesday.
I'm good for whatever you guys are.
Okay. Brian Clark.
Have a good weekend.
Take care. Brian is the West Coast reporter at the Next Web. He's got more stories up there about PSN, the Xbox Live being down, how you survive. So go check that out at the Next Web. And he's at Brian Clark on Twitter.
That's right. Thanks again, Brian.
Take care.
We'll talk to you soon. Bye.
Bye.
All right, TNT's fan of the day is Curtis Gabeau Jr., I hope I'm saying that right, on Twitter, who shared this picture of his setup saying he also, so not only, you know, has 1, 2, 3, 4, 5-ish screens that I can see there watching the show, he also sometimes watches in HoloLens. And so there are at least a couple that we know of that watch this show in HoloLens. I just think that's awesome. I want to see what that's like. Show us how you watch or listen to TNT. Just record a video or take a picture of yourself or your setup. Post it on Instagram, Google+, Twitter, or Facebook. Use the hashtag #HowIWatchTNT, and we're going to find it.
After the break, how you and your phone can celebrate Halloween this year. But first, let's take a minute to thank Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans, the sponsor of this episode. Okay, so back in the olden days, when you got a mortgage, you had to travel all over town. You had to find a bunch of paperwork, look for it. I don't know where it is, but now you don't have to do that anymore. It's easy. You can do everything from your house and then they'll come to you. And so you can sign it. You don't ever have to leave. You don't even have to get dressed. That's Rocket Mortgage. They bring the mortgage process into the 21st century. It's fast, it's powerful, it's completely online. Rocket Mortgage has taken all the complicated, time-consuming parts of applying for a mortgage out of the equation. With Rocket Mortgage, you can easily share your bank statements and your pay stubs just at the touch of a button that helps you get approved in minutes for a custom mortgage solution that's been tailored to your unique financial situation. With Rocket Mortgage, you can do all of this on your phone or your tablet. It's a quick online process that you can manage from the convenience of your couch. So if you are looking to refinance your mortgage or if you're about to buy a home, take a look at Rocket Mortgage. Just take a look at it. It's at quickenloans.com/TNT. That's quickenloans.com/TNT. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states. NMLS, consumeraccess.org, number 3030. And we thank Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans for their support. The website Unique Find has a Halloween costume, not for you, but for your iPhone. The $24 skin lets you dress up your iOS device from an iPhone 5 to an iPhone 7 as a burnt Samsung Galaxy Note 7 or as a burnt iPhone, because as we know, iPhones also catch on fire. So it just covers your whole, the front and back of your phone if you want to dress up.
It looks like a Google Maps thing. It looks like a landscape or something from the top down.
It's called Explodosung iPhone skin. They also have ones that with cracked screens. And The Verge also had a story about the Halloween costume for you. I don't know if this is called recall or fire hazard. And we're not sure where the smoke comes from. I think that we might have a picture of it there. It's a guy that taped a bunch of Samsung Galaxy Note 7 phones. And then
that's a good holiday or a Halloween costume.
I'm hoping that it's dry ice in there, not vaping. But, you know, to each his own. Also, he's got some complaints. If you go to wherever he posted this image, like people think it kind of looks like he's going to, it's a vest, like a, you know, that they're all going to explode. So I don't know if I recommend this in the age we live in now.
I didn't think about that.
Yeah.
I just thought it was a unique looking costume.
Right. Well, he made sure to say that they don't actually blow up.
Okay, good.
Yeah, I think he posted on Imgur or something like, this is not, you know, dear police, this is not going to explode.
So I have two of these boxes mm-hmm. from the two that I've gotten. So I'm a third of the way there.
Well, do you want people to send you their boxes?
No, I'm not going to go as
a
smoldering Samsung Galaxy Note 7 case for Halloween. But I appreciate the creativity.
Mm-hmm, I do,
I think it was really well done. I don't know how, integrating the smoke into it, that's a level that I don't understand.
Right.
Well, I could tape them to me, but doing this whole smoke thing, I couldn't do.
He has a how-to, and it's like tubing and everything, but he doesn't explain where the smoke comes from. And he says that it's a two-part costume. His wife is going to dress as a firefighter all around.
Okay, I like that. That makes it even better. That is it for today. TNT records live every Monday through Friday at 4 p.m. Pacific, 7 p.m. Eastern, 11 p.m. UTC at twit.tv/live. You can be part of the show by emailing us at tnt@twit.tv. You can leave us a short voicemail. That's 260-TNT-SHOW. You can find us on Twitter. We're at Tech News Today TV.
And Twit is now also on the said smart assistant flash briefing. Every day you can get updates on the latest tech news and events from Leo, Jason, and me. To hear Twit's flash briefing, be sure to go to the settings in your said smart assistant app, search for Twit, and subscribe. It is a great way to start your morning. And if you like it, leave a review. You can leave a review in the said smart assistant app. And find all the ways to subscribe to our show at twit.tv/TNT. And if you want to tweet at me with something else to say instead of said smart assistant, I am at Maggie Maroney.
There's got to be something, because I'm going to get tongue-tied saying that too many times. I'm Jason Howell on Twitter. Thanks to our technical director, Kara. Thanks to Mario. Thanks to Kevin. All of them make us look good and make our jobs a lot easier. So thank you, guys. And thanks to you for talking tech with us today. We'll see you all on Monday. Have a great weekend. Bye.